From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made during the month of June in Kabul, Afghanistan. How much were you paying attention to Afghanistan in June? Did it seem like something you should be following? Were you aware that the American exit had begun, that the Taliban was rather rapidly consolidating their gains in southern Afghan cities? The clock was ticking faster than just about anyone knew at the time, and the window to evacuate both Americans and Afghan allies was getting tighter. Many in the foreign policy establishment professed confidence that the Afghan army could hold, or at the very least, it would be a drawn-out set of battles. It would go on months, maybe a couple of years. That was wrong, and in retrospect, it's easy to wonder how many more people we could have pulled out of the country safely. But then imagine that scenario, ramping up evacuations, all while claiming that the government of Ashraf Ghani was prepared to lead. It could have sped up the collapse. Maybe we'd have been right back in the same place, only sooner. But what about the years of bureaucratic delays in processing the applications of Afghan SIVs? Why didn't the powers that be listen to the many people who asked for help, for a swifter process? Hasn't that cost lives? And as we survey the lessons from Afghanistan, will we ever attempt nation building again? Should we? How do we apply these lessons to other places? My guest this hour was the Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of African Affairs at the U.S. Department of State back in 2007 and 2008. He's a Rochester native. He's the Executive Director of the Energy for Growth Hub in Washington, D.C., and a fellow on the Baker Institute at Rice University. He has one of the longest resumes of anyone I know, and it's nice to have Todd Moss back on Connections. Todd, welcome. How are you?
Great to be with you, Evan.
Let's just start with whether you were surprised at what you saw, and whether that's August 15th in particular, or the last two and a half weeks. Are you surprised at what you've seen?
Well, what I'm not surprised is that things don't go the way we expect them to. The world is very messy. You know, even as we try to be well-informed citizens, it's very hard to know what's really going on in a place like Afghanistan. It's even hard for the president, for his intelligence agencies, to fully understand what's going on there. So none of that surprises me that things evolve in ways we don't expect. But I do think one thing that everybody knew and have known for years is that our visa process is fundamentally broken. It takes months, if not years, for people to get through that process. And our promises to get our allies out were dependent on making that process work. And we did not do that. And we knew that that process was broken when we withdrew a couple of days ago. So that is, you know, there's no question that was known at that time.
I want to talk to you about sort of how much you think the public pronunciations reflected, and I know there's a lot of speculation, or you got to be careful, but how much the public pronunciations reflected what, whether it was the Biden team, the State Department, what they actually knew. Because, you know, when Joe Biden says, we're not going to have another Saigon moment, when the generals are saying they've got confidence in the Afghan army, that this could be a protracted fight, but they think that the army can hold. I mean, none of that, it's not that they were wrong. It's that they were wrong at a breathtaking amount. And what you wonder is, on the ground, how much did they go, look, we know this could fall apart instantly. What is more likely there, Todd?
Well, again, you know, there's going to be a range. You know, President Biden was certainly receiving a range of assessments. I don't think, and so we don't know what information he had to make his choice. What I find particularly frustrating, and I know a lot of my colleagues and peers, and I'm sure every single one of the 800,000 Americans that served in Afghanistan and worked alongside Afghans, and the vast majority of whom are worried about their colleagues, and many have been working furiously to try to get them out. I think what is frustrating is that as things started to go wrong and become obviously wrong, that there was no adjustment to the strategy. It was this determination to stick with an arbitrary exit date, no matter the cost to Americans, no matter the cost to Afghans, and no matter the cost to American credibility. And I think that that is the thing that I just find most infuriating.
Well, and on the subject of what infuriates people, I want to listen to a clip, if we could. This is from Ezra Klein's podcast. Ezra Klein, a columnist for The New York Times, also hosts a twice-weekly podcast through The New York Times portal. And he had Robert Wright on last Friday, who is a journalist and an author who has focused on foreign policy in his work. And this is what Robert Wright said that we need to learn from this episode, not only as it applies to Afghanistan, but as we look at U.S. foreign policy writ large.
It's very hard to pour as much in the way of resources as we poured into Afghanistan to support the government and to build up the military without a lot of corruption creeping in. And it did. And this became known among the people that the leaders of the government had their condos in various countries other than Afghanistan and so on. And one reason this became such a problem for us is that, in general, the truth about Afghanistan just didn't find its way back to people who mattered in America. And that was an institutional problem. You know, I've been reading this book, The Best and the Brightest by David Halberstam, about how we got into Vietnam. And one thing he says is, when you're deciding whether to intervene militarily, you can count on the generals to tell you everything that can go awry and stress the negative part of the picture. But once they're invested, once it's their job to create a good outcome through military means, it's going to be all happy talk. They're not going to report that they're failing. They're going to give you the sunnier side of what's happening, in this case, in Afghanistan. And that's what happened. The reports coming back, not only from the military, but also, I think, through the State Department largely, were sunnier than they should have been. And so we didn't see all the ways the government was failing to win the allegiance of people in various parts of Afghanistan, and we didn't understand the reasons that the Taliban was. And we've seen that. We now understand how little we understood. You know, when we look at how fast this whole thing collapsed, we realize we had no idea how fragile the thing we had built was.
All right, Todd Moss, there's a lot there, and I want to work through it sort of piece by piece. First of all, what Robert Wright is essentially saying there is that when you have that much money invested, call it nation building, corruption is almost inevitable. And corruption happened at a huge scale in Afghanistan. But when you're talking about billions upon billions of dollars to build schools, to build infrastructure, to essentially remake a society, it's going to get corrupted. Do you share that view?
So look, anytime you take a society that's fragile and not very wealthy and you pour a lot of resources in, it's going to be destabilizing. There's no way it's not going to be. However, I absolutely reject the notion that you sometimes hear that the problem is Afghan corruption. You know, we have a serious problem of corruption in our country. I work around the world in countries that also struggle with corruption. And that is victim blaming. And I would absolutely reject that. I'm not saying there isn't corruption in Afghanistan. I'm sure it was quite bad, but that's not the fundamental reason that the American mission collapsed, and it's absolutely not the fundamental reason that we've now got thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of our allies stuck behind Taliban lines.
What does corruption look like in this kind of an effort on the American side? Is it contractors who benefit? Is it something else?
Well, there's certainly a lot of contractor benefit. Eventually we will know the data, but if you look there, you know, billions of dollars were spent on Afghanistan in air quotes, but the vast, vast majority of those resources came back to American companies. Mm-hmm. And that wealth was transferred largely from American taxpayers to other well-connected Americans. It is not that that hundreds of billions of dollars were dumped on poor Afghans and they squandered it. That's just absolutely untrue.
Okay, and just sort of as a tangent to the notion of you feel like there's some level of victim blaming, if the conversation veers in a direction that says, well, the corruption happened and the corruption happened with Afghan leadership. I mean, certainly I understand why people feel like President Ghani was corrupt. There were reports that he fled with millions of dollars in a bag. I don't know how true that is, but I can certainly understand the plausibility of it. But I take your point. I take your point on don't victim blame. Do you feel that President Biden engaged in a little bit of victim blaming when he talked about, hey, if those soldiers won't fight for themselves, the Afghan army, if they won't fight them for themselves, we can't fight for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that reflects, you know, a kind of cynical view that the problem is that, you know, that the Afghans weren't sufficiently motivated to defend themselves. I think that that's, you know, that's playing to a particular audience in the United States, and I find it pretty distasteful. I would say one of the interesting things that that Robert Wright mentioned is talking about nation building. You asked about that. It is really difficult. It doesn't happen magically, and it's never quick. The simple truth is that it's virtually impossible to reshape foreign societies. But you can work with allies to help strengthen their institutions. We do that with many of our allies. And the way that it works is when it's done thoughtfully and in the context of building on existing social structures, and you adapt as you go. And fundamentally, it is not a good task for the U.S. military. It is a civilian task. And if you look at how imbalanced our foreign policy is, we massively underfund our civilian agencies. Just as an example, in the Biden budget request, you could fit 15 State Departments and 15 USAID, that's the development agency, 15 of those inside just the Defense Department budget. So we've got a real imbalance. And I also think it's pretty unfair to put that on U.S. military leadership.
Okay. So there's two things there. I want to continue the conversation on nation building there. But let me just close the loop on one point. It sounds to me like you think that corruption is a problem, but I'm not sure that you think it's inevitable every time we attempt something like this. Do you think it's inevitable?
Look, whenever there's huge resources on the table, people are going to try to figure, and this applies everywhere, including in the United States, people are going to figure out how to get a piece of it. That is, I think, you know, not to be overly cynical, but I think that's part of human nature. We can do certain things to make that less likely, like be very transparent about where we're spending money. When it's done in the dark, it disappears more quickly. But if we think about our own history, if we think about the problems that we're dealing with today in with our own government at the local level, at the federal level, you know, corruption is really a part of human nature, and we can build institutions and do things like be transparent about budgets and be open about things like procurement, which can help mitigate those risks. And, you know, we, you know, obviously that didn't go very well in Afghanistan. But again, I just don't think we should think that it's something like, you know, that Afghans or others, you know, certain nationalities are more prone to this than others. That's just, you know, that's pretty outrageous. And I hear that a lot working in Africa. And I work in African, some African countries that are far more open, transparent, and less prone to corruption than parts of the United States. So it's not inevitable.
Okay. In this particular case, though, we had in 2019 the Washington Post publishing what they called the Afghanistan Papers. And it was a series of interviews and new information that gave, for the first time, something close to a full picture of what the foreign policy establishment, and I say that sort of with the gaze at generals, military, presidential administrations, diplomats, State Department. Everybody seemed to know that the Afghan army was not prepared, that they were not going to handle themselves on their own if we were gone, that the second we left, things could collapse, that the Taliban was getting a bigger foothold than much of the American public probably understood. All of those things were there 2 years ago, and it's almost like that reporting barely registered. I don't know if we're all so cynical or inured to it, but I mean, it didn't hit like the Pentagon Papers, and I don't really know why that is. But I don't find it acceptable, you know, whether it's the Ryan Crockers of the world or otherwise. I mean, it does to me, Todd, feel like just about everybody spun this thing hard to the American public. And can you convince me otherwise? I mean, was there any part of this machine that didn't kind of know what the other was doing or was a little more forthright? Or am I being too cynical there?
Well, look, I think that your point that, well, everybody knew that it wasn't going well just goes to, you know, to your initial point that we should not have been surprised that it was that the government collapsed so quickly and that the window for evacuation closed so fast. That, again, goes to this idea that in an uncertain world where we don't know what's going to happen and we don't have all the information we need to make really good decisions, we should be very adaptable. We should do something and then adapt and change our minds as conditions on the ground change. And I think one of my big lessons is that the administration got it in their heads, for whatever reason, I won't speculate why, that they had to be out by September 11th. I think, you know, somebody, you know, I will speculate here that somebody in the White House thought that September 11th was going to be an important symbolic date and there would be a celebratory photo op. But given that they stuck to that, I actually believe that September 11th next week is going to be a day of national shame. It is not going to be a celebration.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that this administration thought the optics of that would play politically. Go ahead, Todd.
Yeah, I'd say the other spin that I think people are seeing right through from the White House is that the White House has framed this as a simple binary choice between an endless forever war versus what we saw, which was an abandonment of our allies. And I think that's both wrong and politically cynical to frame it that way. There are obviously many, many options in between. There were only 2,500 troops in Afghanistan when President Biden came to office. That is not a major U.S. overseas commitment. There are many, you know, many options. I find it actually inexplicable that there wasn't a delay where you could make it based on we will stay until our allies are out. And I think that's especially true because it was very well known that the delay is largely our own fault. It's largely that the State Department did not have the staffing and process in place to get those visas through the pipeline. We knew that. So it is literally our own red tape that was a major hangup. And I believe that it's ethically wrong and strategically a mistake to let your allies die because of your own red tape. So that is the part I find so inexplicable.
All right, so the pushback would probably sound something like this, that if we set a condition for our evacuation on removing our allies first, that is a signal that there is no future for the Ghani administration, for the sort of the securability of the country. And this administration, just like the previous one, was sort of playing this game that said, no, they can do it. They can do this on their own. Everybody's been saying that for 20 years, that eventually they'll be able to do it on their own. Yes, they will. And we don't have to evacuate everybody because it will be a secure country. It'll be a prosperous and growing Kabul. It'll be a place that people can still feel comfortable being. So setting these conditions. Now, maybe what you're saying is, when things started to fall like dominoes, we weren't out yet. We could have privately or whatever said, like, look, you think you're going all the way here. It's not happening until everyone's out at that point.
You could credibly make that argument in early July. You know, you cannot credibly make that argument in the latter half of August. I don't think that makes sense. And, you know, when we look at how many people are still stuck behind. I have a very close friend who served in Afghanistan. She was working to help 23 former colleagues get out. One of them has made it to Canada. 22 of the 23 are still stuck behind the lines. I know that you've had Ellen Smith from Keeping Our Promise on the radio a couple of times. You know, I know she tells these heartbreaking stories of people that she knows who are stuck, some of whom are disappearing. And really, it's, you know, it's those individual stories. And this is where I wonder whether the political calculation is going to come back and bite the White House. So, you know, obviously, you know, there's a great piece in The Atlantic by Sasha Monk, where he's saying that the polls may say that American voters prefer a self-interested foreign policy, but they will judge their leaders very harshly if their actions humiliate the country or they fail to protect the homeland. I totally agree with that. And for all of those people who have Afghan connections, and it's not just a handful, it's hundreds of thousands of Americans have Afghan colleagues and allies who they are worried about. That is going to, I believe that is going to come back and haunt the White House.
Yeah, and interestingly, you know, Yasha is sort of center left, made a very forceful argument against this evacuation withdrawal. The argument that defended it best came from the right and Ross Douthat in the New York Times. And I, if you could, Todd, I would appreciate hearing you address some of the contention he is making, which I'm going to try to sum it up here. But essentially that's, you know, 2,500 American personnel or not, that's enough of a force that two things are happening. That, yes, in the last 18 months, we didn't take casualties because of various deals that were struck, but 15,000 Afghans did. There were attacks across the country on Afghan military installations, Afghan cities, that those attacks are still happening, and that is tied to our presence, that our presence is preventing anything approaching a credible government going forward. No one is saying the Taliban should be viewed as what anybody hopes is a long-term government. But, you know, Clarissa Ward from CNN reports that when you talk to people on the ground, what they want is stability and peace, and they haven't had that in 20 years. And some are now willing to take it in any form as long as there's not the threat of explosions every night or drone strikes, et cetera. And that, yes, 2,500, but what is the goal? What is, if the goal is not a credible government, if we recognize that we failed there, what exactly are we doing other than creating a kind of protectorate?
So there's, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking this is, you know, very easy, but I think it's important to separate two separate issues. One is, should the U.S. have kept a military presence there? What would that have looked like? What would that have tried to achieve in the long term? That is a question that we will be debating for decades. But the separate question, I think the immediate question, and it is a different question, even though the White House would like us to think it's the same thing, a different question is, if we are getting out, how do we do that? How do we manage the withdrawal when it is, once we've decided we are pulling out, how do we manage that withdrawal in a way that protects American lives, protects our allies, and lives up to the obligations that we made to people who risk their lives to work for us? And the moral question is, people who work for the United States government, and it's not just the military, they might have worked for Voice of America, they might have worked for a development contractor, they might have worked for an American company. Any of those people are now, because of their association with the United States, are now explicitly at risk. And that creates a moral need for the United States to get that evacuation right. And we clearly did not get the evacuation right. And I actually think people saying, well, you know, it's not Korea and we couldn't stay there forever. You know, that is a separate question about how we evacuate and how, and whether we abandon living, breathing friends of ours.
Yeah,
and I think that's the issue.
I do think there are some people, a significant number of people, who've worked in foreign policy who are using a criticism of the evacuation to sort of dodge the idea that we should or shouldn't be there in perpetuity. And they're sort of using criticism of the evacuation as a way to sort of cleverly argue for continued presence there. I don't think you're doing that. I think you're making a cogent case that this could have been handled very differently and that we had a moral obligation to handle it differently and we failed there. And I hear that. I do hear that. But if we would have continued with, say, 2,500, whatever the number is, how do you define the goal, especially now that there's been enough public vetting of this, whether it's the Washington Post reporting 2 years ago or otherwise, that says there's been corruption at a huge scale, there's money missing, that the Afghan army is not ready, that we failed in many of our objectives. What would our goal be going forward? I think what you're saying, Todd, correct me if I'm wrong, I think what you're saying is that credibly protecting the homeland may mean sort of messy entanglements to keep a foothold and prevent even more nefarious and dangerous acts. And I think the critics of that idea, and maybe I'm criticizing the wrong idea, the critics of that might say our very presence is creating a recruitment effort for the ISISs and the Al-Qaedas. So how do you take those?
Yeah. So look, Evan, I think you're trying to put a nuance on here that I think is absolutely needed, right? So first, you know, there are places where American presence is destabilizing. There are places where an American presence would be stabilizing. It's not, you cannot make a blanket statement that American troops overseas are always going to make things worse. And you can't say that they will always make things better. So that needs to be determined on a case by case basis with, you know, eyes wide open and the best intelligence you can get at the time. It's also the case that it does, you know, American influence abroad is not only about troops on the ground. There are a whole range of engagements. We engage with every country on the planet, and that engagement gets calibrated based on our interests, what we think we're trying to achieve in different places, and how it's going. And I think that this notion that we should, because of a couple of failed ventures, including obviously Afghanistan, that nation building is something we should just stay away from, I think that's utterly unrealistic. Because the threats that we face as a nation cannot be managed by us just kind of pretending that we are protected by oceans and we're going to forget about the rest of the world. That's the reason we got into Afghanistan in the first place. And, you know, I think if I can talk about a region that I know much better than Afghanistan, which is West Africa, there's a very similar challenge in West Africa. France actually has troops in West Africa. There are some pretty nasty groups in that part of the world. A lot of them emerged from the collapse of Libya after Muammar Gaddafi died. They are still there. Some of them are linked with Al-Qaeda and ISIS. They're sort of local franchises of those groups. They will attack Western targets, they will attack our allies, and they do intend to have be part of a global movement that is a fundamental existential threat to us and to our prosperity and to our security. And the idea that we're just going to be able to ignore that, I think, is completely naive. But I also do not think that us putting 100,000 troops into West Africa would be constructive. So, you know, I think the foreign policy making is a lot more art than science. But you've got to the United States has got to stay engaged in the world and not allow our failure in Afghanistan to have us stick our head in the sand.
All right. Let me get some listener feedback here. First, John in Irondequoit. Go ahead, John.
Yes, how you doing, Evan?
Good, sir.
Hey, real quick, I had heard this talked about, and I wondered what your take was on it. And it sort of speaks to the corruption that was, within the Afghan government. My understanding, or what they had talked about, was that the Afghan army that we've been training really had no interest or intention of fighting once we were gone. And once Trump announced our pullout in May, they had negotiated with the Taliban for a handover of the country. And I was curious, is there intelligence on this? Did we know about this, or is this even a thing? I had heard it talked about, and I was wondering what your take was on it.
Okay. Todd, any knowledge there?
Yeah, so I don't have any particular insight on this, you know, beyond what I've read in the Washington Post. But I do think it's kind of, you know, if you put yourself in a soldier's position, you have been defended by the United, it's air support from the United States, trained by the United States. They've announced that they're pulling out. At some point you start to think, okay, how am I going to manage this? And then quickly it can become a turning point where the obvious smart thing for you to do is to cut a deal with the Taliban, lay down your weapons. And once that tipping point has been reached, it actually happens quite quickly, which is exactly what we saw. So it's actually pretty rational. And I don't think the takeaway is that the Afghan army never intended to fight and we should have known better. It's that we should have seen that the way we were withdrawing was creating very powerful incentives for those troops to lay down their weapons and cut a deal. So that, you know, to me, that again points to this idea that Afghans are just like everybody else. They're going to try to make their best assessment of the risks that they face and try to make the most rational decision.
Well, and I can actually understand a little bit of the psychology of that when it comes on the heels of the 2020 deal that the Trump administration reached with the Taliban. And the Trump administration wasn't working with the Afghan sort of backed leadership backed by the West. They struck a deal with the Taliban. They knew who was going to be in charge. And when that happens, I can't imagine Afghan soldiers thinking, well, yeah, you know, they struck this deal with the Taliban to be out by May 31st, but I'm sure this is going to go just fine for us. Nick writes to say, Evan, the only spin we've seen from the media is how this is the greatest tragedy of all time. The majority of Americans wanted us out of Afghanistan. If it was a war, it was a war we should never have been in the first place. Your current guest seems to be ignoring the fact that President Trump signed the deal with the Taliban, and that's why we were able to have so few troops recently in Afghanistan. And without the deal to leave, that situation would have been untenable with more American lives lost. What do you think, Ted?
Well, look, I'm not going to defend the Trump agreement with the Taliban, but I do think that it did not put Biden in a very strong position. But again, that points to this idea that we should be adapting as events on the ground change and not stick to an arbitrary date because we think it's going to bring us a political benefit. And, you know, I think I actually take some issue with what, you know, I think I'm a little bit like more like Yasha Monk on this, in that I don't read too much into some of the polls, because I think Americans still think of our country as special. We still stand for our values and not just power and money. And I still believe that Americans want to support democracy and human rights. In Afghanistan, I believe that, you know, Afghans want girls in school. They want Afghan girls in school. And I do think that Americans think that we're better. We are not all just cynical schemers. And I think that, you know, in polling, you could say we want the war to end, but I don't think they want to do it in a way that violates the fundamental values that Americans believe, that we are generous, we are kind, we are trustworthy. And that we are credible friends and allies. I think that almost all Americans believe that. And when that gets violated, that will swamp any sense that, well, we had to get out regardless of the cost. I think that's a minority.
Before I get back to the phones, let me read an email that I think extends on the issue that Todd is talking about here. Rich in Fairport says, European countries recognize that the United States can no longer be the country to police the world. It appears that the world's democracies need to take a more active role in addressing the needs of countries in need. That's from Rich in Fairport. So, Todd, first of all, I guess I'm curious to know if you agree with that. But second of all, when you talk about your belief that Americans recognize the importance of, girls having rights, women and girls being protected, Afghans wanting girls to go to school, et cetera. There are other nations where women are oppressed. I was going to say similarly. I mean, every case is different, but how do you decide where to wield power to try to address that?
Yeah. So look, you know, the United States, we have a lot of goals around the world, and they're not all equal, and they're not all, we're not going to have the same list of priorities in every place. So we obviously will not be sending the Marines into very many places to support women and girls. That's just, not a realistic expectation. However, when we, Afghanistan is not a blank slate. It is a country that we had invaded for other reasons. And once you're there, that gives you an obligation to try to live up to what you say your values are. And when the choice is pulling out and having a particular effect on women and girls, you have to own that. You have to own that responsibility. Now, to get to the caller's specific question about cooperation, look, one of the big goals that the Biden administration had, which I 100% support, is that we had to get the United States back into international cooperation. There is no way that we can achieve our goals acting alone. We need our European allies. We need our African allies, our Asian allies, our allies in the Middle East and Latin America. We just do. I don't think that there's any question about that. And there was a lot made by the Biden administration that America is back, particularly with the Europeans. And I think that the events over the last couple of weeks in Afghanistan have been a fundamental problem for that. The Europeans are furious with us. Our credibility, I think, is out the window. And that very difficult task of rebuilding trust among our allies has just become that much more difficult. I think we'll see that in a lot of ways. We're seeing that we're going to see that on global health with vaccines. We're going to see that in November in Glasgow at the global climate talks. The U.S. is now back on its heels because of Afghanistan. I wish it wasn't the case, but I'm afraid that I think that it is.
Okay. Now, the Robert Wrights of the world, as you know, are arguing that in the long term, this will increase our credibility because we've talked for 20 years about leaving this war, that the American public generally, as you say, was behind it, though I take your point, I take Yash Monk's point, many others, that could change. But for the moment, this was one of the rare cases of agreement. I mean, the reason that Donald Trump in May, June, into July was bragging at his own rallies that this was all his idea is because he thought this was a good idea, and he thought politically it played. The reason that Kamala Harris tried to get her name inserted sort of as one of the credit holders for this decision is because she thought this is a political winner. So this has been popular in both parties, and that's probably because it's pretty popular among the average American rank and file. And so the Robert Wrights of the world argue that, yes, the foreign policy establishment doesn't like it, and they've got a view of what gives us credibility, but what will give Joe Biden credibility is, and this will be the only time I ever quote Ann Coulter, but Ann Coulter said the only difference between Trump and Biden on Afghanistan was that Biden had the blank to go through with it when Trump didn't. And Wright is saying, the courage to follow through and say this is the right thing to do, even if it's going to be hard, will give us more credibility. I take it that is not a plausible scenario to you.
Well, look, I think it's Americans should be in favor of ending wars, right? We all should be in favor of that. But I don't think at you know, I don't think that, you know, that the way that this has been handled is going to be, is going to make people feel good about, is going to make people feel good about it. I also think it is kind of painfully cynical to say, well, Americans won't care in the November 2022, you know, midterm elections, or in November 2024, they'll have forgotten about Afghanistan by then. I find that sort of a nauseating calculation. I also think this is going to be a fundamental challenge to the White House's goal of what they're calling a foreign policy for the middle class, right? They want to get American policies abroad more connected to the pocketbook issues of regular Americans. It's a nice slogan, but let's think for a second, really, about what's the best way to create jobs in Rochester or raise incomes in, you know, Detroit or St. Louis. I don't see how that's going to come from foreign policy issues directly. It's definitely not going to be helped by a foreign policy debacle and a national humiliation like we've seen in Kabul. So I think that whole notion sounds good, but the implementation really matters. If this had gone smoothly, if we did not have thousands of people worried about the lives of our Afghan allies right now who were left behind despite promises that no one would be left behind, then he could be claiming some kind of pivotal moment in U.S. policy. But I think they bungled this so badly that's at risk.
All right, Jane in Rochester. Hi, Jane, go ahead.
So the statement was made that there was a lot of corruption along the way, U.S. corruption. The defense industry is in league with the government and so forth. You know, Harry Truman went after the war profiteers. There was a consequence. As long as we don't do that, and it is said, as you said, it's human nature, diminishing the importance of the crimes committed, fraud, theft, whatever, war profiteering by the military and defense industry establishment, probably it won't cease because it pays well. I just want to tell you that it's astounding to me that it could be said that all of this profiteering is simply human nature. That offends me. Thank you.
All right, Jane. Todd Moss, anything you want to add to that?
Look, I do think there are going to absolutely be hearings about this, and we will be hearing a lot more about where that money went, what went wrong with the war, what went wrong with the Afghan army, and what went wrong with the evacuation. There's no question about this. And I think, you know, my contacts on Capitol Hill, every single congressional office has been inundated with panicked requests for help. And I think that there's going to be a very strong push from the Hill, from both Democrats and Republicans, to try to find out what really went wrong here. But I do want to say, you know, I think human nature also has a really wonderful side, that I don't want this to all be doom and gloom. And, you know, I mentioned keeping our promise, the local Rochester NGO. And one of the things that makes me so proud of Rochester has really been showing that human nature of helping other humans, helping them resettle, especially those that have gone through a trauma, like being forced to flee your country, and helping to build a new life. And groups like Alan Smith's have just really done incredible, tremendous work that all Rochesterians should be really proud of, that their community is one of the standouts across the country for welcoming Afghans. And I know that they're preparing now to take in a lot more Afghans. So that's, you know, something really good that your listenership should be really proud of.
Here's what the Washington Post offered, because I want to start to close the program based on some of what Ellen Smith said on this program last week. And she said she realizes this is a moment in the world when nation building is not viewed with anything beyond much of suspicion. And she said, as unpopular as it may be, she thought that was the only route forward to protect and save girls, women, and our allies in Afghanistan. And she believed that as hard as it was, that it didn't have to be as corrupt as we had made it and that we could have done it. And I admire Ellen for the work that she does for all the reasons Todd just highlighted, but I also admire her for saying, look, this is an unpopular position, but I'm going to take this up publicly because I'm worried about folks. I think everybody is doing their best to figure out the best way forward to help as many people as possible. The question is, what's effective? Well, here's something that Joe Biden said. In fact, the Washington Post fact check hits a number of things. The president has been saying all summer that we didn't go to Afghanistan to nation build, that we had all kinds of mission creep, that we shouldn't be doing that. That was never the point. Here's what Joe Biden said October 8th, 2001, in an interview on CBS News. Brian Gumbel asked Joe Biden, Senator Biden, should we be in the business of nation building? Joe Biden responded, absolutely, along with the rest of the world. June 26, 2002, describing a conversation he had with a White House aide after meeting with President Bush. Senator Biden said, well, the aide asked, you're not going to mention nation building, are you? And I said, you mean what the president has spoken to me about for the last hour and 45 minutes? I said, no, I won't mention that. There's an incredible hang-up on this notion about nation building, just the use of my phrase and my experience. We can succeed in Afghanistan if we're not afraid of it. He has changed his mind. It's okay to change your mind. But he should be honest about that. He shouldn't say we never got in there to nation build. He was one of the decision makers, and it was clear from just months in that he thought we could. Todd Moss, he says that was never going to be the goal. Can you point to places where we have done this successfully? Because one of the things I think you said earlier this hour is it's hard to do it with just the military, and you need some civilian support. You need infrastructural support. It's easier to build it on a base of a country that's sort of already developing. But can you point to places where you'd say, yes, nation building works here?
So I think that the label nation building is actually very misleading, right?
Okay.
So if by nation building, do you mean, can we go to a foreign country and reshape a society in our image with our institutions? The answer to that is no. If we think we can do that, if we think our governance in a box, or we can land somewhere and a little bit of training and they're suddenly going to behave like we are, that is utterly unrealistic. It's naive, and I don't see why anybody would think that would work. But what nation building should really be about is working with allies toward achieving mutual goals. Could the United States, turn Afghanistan into, the next Connecticut? Of course not. But could the United States work with allies in Afghanistan, in Mali, in Nigeria, in Paraguay, in Jordan, to support girls in school? Absolutely. Could we work to help strengthen governance? Absolutely. Could we help to make people more educated, more healthy, to help create jobs, to help create markets that can that can create industries to make people more prosperous? Absolutely. That is what foreign policy is all about. So if we get away from this notion that we've got to replicate the American model everywhere, and we just try to make incremental progress, then we can achieve a lot. And so, again, this is like this notion that we've got a binary choice between abandonment and all in at one extreme. I think is just, that's just a cynical political distraction. So I actually agree with Ellen that we could have made a lot of progress that would be short of turning Afghanistan into Connecticut, but would be a lot better than the risks that we're seeing that country and its people face today.
Last couple of minutes, then, what are the lessons you want us as a country to take from this going forward?
Well, I think the most important is a sense of humility. The United States is a wealthy, powerful nation. But we had, there are very, you know, very clear limits on what we can achieve. And especially when we act unilaterally, we live in a complicated, very, dangerous world. And we face a lot of different risks that are evolving all of the time. And the only way we're going to be able to manage those risks and continue to thrive and be prosperous and secure country, is by working with allies. And alliances overseas are built on trust. And this is what I think frustrates me a lot about Afghanistan, is how much trust we have squandered with obviously with Afghans, but also with our other allies. And I think that the U.S. government has squandered a lot of trust with the American people. Like a lot of your callers, they can't believe we got it this wrong. And that's a very understandable notion. But what I hope we'll take away from this is that with a bit of humility, that we can still engage in the world in a way that's good for us and good for our allies. It's just absolutely unrealistic that we're going to just retreat inside our borders. I just don't see that as realistic or as helping our security or our prosperity.
Todd Moss served as Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of African Affairs at the U.S. Department of State back in 2007 and 2008. He's a Rochester native who serves as the Executive Director of the Energy for Growth Hub in Washington, D.C., and a fellow of the Baker Institute at Rice University. Todd, I appreciate the time. Thank you for making it for the program.
Always wonderful to talk to you, Evan. Thank you.
That's Todd Moss. And listeners, if we didn't get through all of your feedback, I just want you to know, this is part of a series of conversations and a series of perspectives on not only Afghanistan, but on our place in the world and some of the lessons we're learning. And we'll have more to say. I know you will too. And more connections coming up in a moment.